This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are covering Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, chapters 19 and 20, The Silver Doe and Xenophilius Lovegood. So, after following a strange old lady we don't know, we're just going to follow some random ass deer ghost.
Why not? I feel like I'd feel more comfortable following the deer ghost than the crazy old lady. And rightfully so.
Yeah. And then we've got Xenophilius Lovegood, who doesn't seem all that happy to see Harry Potter.
No. He kind of seems a little... He's trying to... Well, we'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But let us begin with chapter 19, where we left off with Harry throwing a little hissy fit because he doesn't feel as close to Dumbledore as he would have liked. And we discussed that in detail, that I don't think Harry would be as pissed off as Hermione says, you know, if Dumbledore had told him all of this. But I think more importantly, I think it wouldn't have mattered if Dumbledore had not told him all of that stuff, if he didn't feel such a visceral, relate so strongly to Ariana.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we're moving on, and yeah, we've got lots of, you know, was it just hanging around? Harry's got dreams about Nagini.
Yeah, he's kind of having some nightmares, which can we blame him? I mean, that was a pretty horrific, like, situation.
I'm just trying to think of what it would be like going through these chapters with Nat, the warden, because, you know, snakes to her are what spiders are to you.
Well, then she and I both are equally terrified, because we get a spider in the next chapter that I wasn't too thrilled to read about.
But it's just so weird because, you know, again, those are such stereotypical fears, no offense, but I'm just thinking so many people in my life, for you, it's spiders, for Nat, it's snakes, for my husband, it's gators and crocodiles. He hates them.
Wow.
Could barely look at them at the zoo. And I'm thinking, like, I don't have an animal that creeps me out or disgusts me. And I'm like, am I weird?
No, I think you're just a good pagan. That's what you are. Like, everything serves its purpose. I'm just, I don't know. I've got a lot of things wrong with me. Spiders are scary.
Yep. And so, at first, when they're starting to leave, it's like, we'll go somewhere more sheltered. I keep thinking I could hear people moving outside, even thought I saw somebody once or twice. And we know who that is, eventually.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yep. But they spirit away to another location, and now they are in the Forest of Dean.
The Forest of Dean, okay.
Which is
this is a new place, right?
It is a real forest in the United Kingdom.
Oh, okay. Okay. But new to the reader. Like, we haven't read about it.
New
to the
reader. Again, Hermione just picks it because she's like, I came camping here once with my mom and dad.
Okay.
Like, literally.
Doesn't seem terrible.
And it's just interesting, just the scale of geography, because, you know, the UK, they're just this dinky island. Like, London was just an outpost in the Roman Empire with a bunch of yokels. No one gave a crap about it. And, you know, it's just so small, and just thinking about the sense of space and, like, hiding from people and, like, being on the lam and stuff, compared to what I think of, like, being on the lam and hiding out in a in a place as vast as the continental United States.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
Yeah, because I didn't even think about that.
Because, you know, because Hermione seems to be the one, like, certain, as always, because she's the boss, because Ron and Hermione, or Ron and Harry don't know what the hell to do with themselves. Like, she's the one right. who's always, like, suggesting, like, new, like, you know, random ass locations. And I just, at this point, was thinking to myself, like, okay, what are all the national parks? If I had magic and was in this situation in the U.S., where would I be going to? I'd be going to this random place in Bryce Canyon, like in Yellowstone, the Oregon Caves. Like, I'd just be going to so right. many, like, various national parks.
The national park, that is pretty interesting, because it's what I thought too and about. And I don't know. There are a lot of stories about the bodies and actual deaths in national parks. For those true crime fans like myself, I kind of think that they're underreported. But I don't know.
Probably, you know what that makes me think of? Not necessarily what's underreported is all the murders of Indigenous women.
Yes, which is horribly underreported and, yeah, under. Publicized. There should be
under-publicized much more coverage of and, that. Yeah, but yeah, and like literally, there is this one group of like both I think white and Indigenous people who like aren't like directly solving crimes. They're just going through all the local bodies of water to dig up bodies, like just doing the things that the police should be doing and just aren't.
Oh my god! Like, I won't take the police. Path, because I don't want to offend anybody. I'm sure we could talk about that. And
yeah, well, that particularly yeah. because a lot of times it's not, you know, surely probably in some cases the police are just being dicks and don't care. But a good chunk of it in the Indigenous context is because technically they're their own sovereign nations.
Yeah,
and so the bureaucratic tape of trying to push those investigations is very complex and complicated and wrought with lots of distrust and all those things.
And the people with criminal minds know those little nuances and how to wiggle through that and do bad things.
So anyway, we're at the Forest of Dean, where probably plenty of other bodies have been buried.
Yeah. Ooh, scary.
Yep. And Harry is taking the night watch. And he's getting bored and he's tempted to bring out the Marauders map just to like watch Ginny for a little bit, but realizing it's still Christmas holiday, she won't be there. And, you know, he has a memory of like when back in his first year, when he saw possessed Quirrell drinking the unicorn blood and his like robe snaking against the like forest floor, the leaves, and he feels like he can hear it again.
Yeah. Ugh. That was a jarring incident.
Yeah, but you should have loved it. It was very vampiric.
I mean, I do love a little bit of vampire-ness, but the poor unicorn. I like horses, too.
Yeah. And then, what is to show up? A bright silver light appeared right ahead of him, moving through the trees. Whatever the source, it was moving soundlessly. The light seemed to just simply drift towards him. So we have this big, bright, shining silver dough.
Yes.
That at first is not, you know, we kind of, did you realize that it was a Patronus before Harry first?
Yes. Yes, I did, just because of the description. I mean, that's how the other Patronuses are kind of described too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so, I don't know, I got in my head, was it Sarah Sanderson's, like, come little children, I'll take thee away.
Yes. Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, Hocus Pocus, that's it. So, yeah, we've got the silver doe luring Harry out. And again, I guess I'm, the big difference here is the innate, quote-unquote, goodness of a Patronus, because this is deep Potter trivia, like this isn't directly mentioned, but it's kind of implied that you have to have a certain level of goodness. Like, it's not just a happy memory that's happy to you, it's like genuinely good, like only genuinely good people can produce Patronuses. So I guess it's that understanding of Patronuses, Patroni, that make Harry possibly make Harry more trusting, because I'm just thinking, oh, it may look pretty, but we were so happy to see Bertha too. What the hell?
Yeah, right.
Or not,
yeah,
Bertha, kind of... Bethilda, excuse me.
Oh.
Yeah, R.I.P. Bertha Jorkins. You will not be forgotten.
I agree. I didn't like suspect anything bad. I think the combination too of a doe, it was kind of like, okay. Now if it would have been like the, you know, I don't know, alligator Patronus or like the shark Patronus, I would have been like, I don't know about this. It might be a little sus, but this one seems pretty fine. Like
the dragon Patronus.
Now you'd probably be like, hell yeah. But I would too. I would too. The spider Patronus, no thanks. But
you just gave me an idea for my fanfic. Thank you.
Hey, anytime.
Who's going to get a spider Patronus? I know that question.
I don't. Ron? I don't know. Anyway.
So yeah, Silver Doe walking all regally and ethereally over, leading Harry to this little pond. And what is in this little pond?
Well, should I give the big reveal? Is that what we're waiting for? The Sword of Gryffindor is in the pond. Like the Lady of the Lake, what is that? The Lady of the Lake, but that's Excalibur.
I think the illusion is supposed to be pretty obvious, because you can't help but think of, you know, Excalibur. Yeah. Because obviously there are a variety of, you know, variants of, you know, Arthurian legends. You know, at the very least, the idea of you have to go through some sort of trial to be able to get the sword.
Yes. Okay.
Whether it's in the like Sword and Stone, like the Disney version, which that movie was awesome. I loved Merlin in that. Awesome. I probably loved that Merlin in Sword and the Stone as much as you love Dumbledore.
Oh man, that's a lot of love there. There was a Merlin recently in a show on Netflix. What was that?
And apparently people did not like how the ending went.
What was that show called?
I think it was called Merlin, because...
Oh, Cursed. I'm thinking of Cursed. There was a show called Merlin about, and I think that was BBC, but Cursed had like a Merlin character, and I thought he was cool.
Which, Deep Potter trivia, Merlin was a Slytherin.
Okay. If it's based on if the Cursed thing is related, the guy in Merlin and Cursed is like kind of drunk, so anyway.
Like a Falstaff?
Yeah, it's also one of the Skarsgård brothers. So anyway, if you're bored, Cursed.
Yeah. So typical, you know, British lore of, you know, you must show your valor to get the sword. And so, yeah, so Harry goes in, he goes into the lake, or not this pond, he goes into the pond, tries to go swim and get the sword, but that seems to trigger some sort of self-preservation instinct on the Horcrux.
Yeah.
Before Harry can get the sword, the locket starts to choke him.
Yeah. So, bad news for Harry.
Yep. But who is there to come to the rescue?
Ron, of all people. Ron.
How shocked were you of him coming back? Maybe timeline of him coming back at this point, and the impact of how he came back. Give me your thoughts.
I'm honestly genuinely surprised, because I think that we've kind of had a recurring, like, it's pretty spot on for his character, though, because he does kind of show up at moments that he kind of proves his worth, for lack of a better phrase, in times that we kind of least expect it. And I know we've talked about how he's smart, but he's also like, he's emotional. I can relate to that as a water sign, but he's also, I don't know. It was surprising in the way he showed up in the acts that he did to kind of save Harry and get the sword. Not the person I honestly didn't expect him to show up until the end of the kind of toward the end of the book again.
Interesting.
I was surprised.
Yeah, because I think I told you there's one Harry Potter fanfic, which I've learned from my fanfic bookbinding group, that is super, super popular. I didn't realize how popular like it was. Like, it has quite a following. Again, this sort, it's a sort of alternative Deathly Hallows where through a whole variety of circumstances, Draco Malfoy ends up tagging along with them for Horcrux hunting. And in that one, Ron does leave. He does get to that point where he cracks, but he's gone for a lot longer. And it's pretty badass what he's been doing in the meantime. But yeah, he's gone for a lot longer in that one. And I think, so Ron comes in and he's like, you idiot. Why would you go into the lake with the Horcrux still on?
Well, I mean, I think Harry probably just got excited. And then also his experience with the Horcrux hasn't been as upsetting as it has to Ron. Ron kind of like had a bad time with the Horcrux.
Yeah, so, of course, Harry's just so happy to see Ron. And Ron originally thinks that the doe is Harry's, but he's like, no, mine's a stag. Mine is male with antlers.
Right. So then they think it's Dumbledore's, right?
Yeah, they theorize about that in the next chapter, and Harry's just like, no, Dumbledore's dead. I saw his body.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with this little doe, but...
Yep, so... Okay. But they're like, okay, we have the Sword of Gryffindor, we have the Horcrux, like, let's destroy it. And it's like, you do it. And Ron is like, no, don't make me. And Ron is admitting like the locket does affects me more than it affects you, and you know, affects Harry and Hermione. Like, he admits that it's not things he wasn't ever not thinking, but it just, you know, like a variety of, you know, addictions or whatever, you know, whatever was the seed that was there, the Horcrux just made it, you know, grow and grow until it exploded.
Yeah, just amplifies the some of his thoughts. I can't relate to that at all.
Yeah, because what does it directly say? You know, because the thing's bad for me, said Ron, backing away. I can't handle it. I'm not making excuses, Harry, for what I was like, but it affects me worse than it affects you and Hermione. It made me think stuff I was thinking anyway, but it made it everything worse. I can't explain it. And then I'd take it off and I'd get my head on straight and again, and then I'd put the effing thing back on. I can't do it, Harry.
Also, like, we're cursing now, finally. We got a hell, we got an F, but it's not the full word. But I just thought that was kind of funny, because it's kind of the first time that showed up, too, in the Harry mm-hmm. Potter book.
Yep. And so, again, Harry finally gets the epiphany that to open the locket of Salazar Slytherin, you might want to say open in Parseltongue.
Parseltongue, yeah. Wow. I mean, he's had a lot on his mind.
Yeah, so Harry opens it, and the locket is, you know, they open it, and there's an eye there. Basically, the sort of, like, a ghost of Tom Riddle's eye.
Yeah.
And I guess there's, you know, if we want to get deep into, like, the mechanics of these Horcruxes, you know, someone pointed out to me, and I think they're right, that it's not the sense of each Horcrux has a... equal part of Voldemort's soul. It's that each time Voldemort split his soul, it was cut further in half. So it kind of gives the illusion that the first Horcrux had like half of his soul, and so when he makes the next Horcrux and he's operating with only like half of the soul he used to have, it's half of that. So it's a quarter, an eighth, and so, like, you know, I interpret that as the more quote-unquote soul a Horcrux has, the more, like, powerful and, like, sentient it is.
So, like, I don't know. So it's kind of like 23 and me, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you're one parent's Irish, one parent's German, and then you're, you know, split.
So I'm interpreting from this is that, given the timeline, the locket would have been one of the fairly earlier Horcruxes, which makes sense why it has, like, kind of a bigger chunk of Voldemort's soul. Why? Because I think the most powerful Horcrux, I think, was the very first one, the diary, which, again, was able to be sentient, to possess Ginny and, like, you know, do things that I don't think even the locket could do. Like, the locket is reacting to a very specific situation, but the diary was, like, able to, like, strategize and, like, think long term.
The interesting thing here if I may, because you mentioned the diary and then the locket, which obviously affects Ron, and then it affected Jenny. So those are two pure blood wizards from the same family. I mean, what have people made of that with the Horcruxes?
Interesting. I have not had that posed, but I think that's an interesting concept of, if we want to get, what is it? Like, maybe because they are quote unquote pure blood, because they're kind of more or less surrounded by magic, that they can, the Horcruxes can like feed on that magic more. Again, not getting into as if, you know, as if they have more magic than like half-bloods or muggleborns. They don't, but they're just, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
I guess let me ask you this. I don't know if a Horcrux is going to affect anybody coming up, because I haven't read it yet. Shocker. It's the whole premise of this podcast. Yeah. But was there anybody in the past that was affected by a Horcrux that was not pure blood?
Pure blood. Well, I plead the fifth.
Okay. Okay.
I plead the fifth, I think the more poignant thing is the Horcruxes can more easily feed on the emotionally vulnerable.
Mm, okay. And, well, that would make sense.
And both Ron and Ginny, again, came for different reasons, were in a place of emotional vulnerability.
Yeah.
And more susceptible to manipulation.
I do think it's an interesting choice to have the Weasley characters. Anyway, we get to talk about what happens with Ron when he's on the Horcrux.
You know, mushroom whatever.
Yeah, yep. Feeling those bad vibes.
Yep, so the Horcrux starts speaking. "I have seen your heart, and it is mine. I've seen your dreams, Ronald Weasley, and I've seen your fears. All you desire is possible, but all that you dread is also possible. Least loved always by the mother who craved a daughter. Least loved now by the girl who prefers your friend. Second best always, eternally overshadowed." You're like making a retching noise.
Ugh. Well, I mean, he's playing on Ron's insecurities. It's pretty.
Yeah. And obviously, I think you're supposed to infer it's a type of hypnosis, not just the words, but there's like, you know, again, some trippy like stuff going on to make Ron like, take this seriously.
Yes, yeah.
Because it's not just the voice, but then two figures come out, basically the demonic versions of Harry and Hermione.
This is what I meant by allusions to some more adult things, which I think I've seen a glimpse of this from the film. And it's like kind of portrayed as like a smoky, like they're kind of in a smoky thing, which is like... Anyway, obviously that's going to upset Ron, because we know why.
"Why return? We were better off without you, happier without you, glad of your absence. We laughed at your stupidity, your cowardice, your presumption. Who could look at you? Who would even look at you beside Harry Potter? What have you ever done compared with the Chosen One? What are you compared with the boy who lived?"
Oh my gosh. I mean, unfortunately, you know, Ron is like, this is really hard for him to hear, and he has to struggle through this. That's how Voldemort does his thing. So,
yeah. "Who wouldn't prefer him? What woman would take you? You are nothing, nothing, nothing to him." And then Riddle Hermione and Riddle Harry start making out.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, Ron is like, whoa. Yes.
It's just funny to listen to Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson like describe this scene, because it was so awkward.
I can imagine, because they seem like they're pretty good friends.
Because they're like, Daniel Radcliffe has never confessed to having like a crush on Emma Watson, and neither she her, but you know, in the way that Emma and Tom Felton have admitted to having crushes on each other.
That's interesting. I could see that it'd be like not, I could see the two actors' relationship reflect Harry and Hermione, and I don't know. I mean, but again, I have a lot of male friends, so.
Yeah.
I get it.
So, and finally, you know, Ron stabs it, Horcrux is destroyed, end the final boss music, the little chest appear, like with Legend of Zelda.
Bing, bing, bing. Yes.
And what I think is not, obviously it's pretty epic that Ron faces his fears, but I, of this chapter, I've always loved the aftermath when Harry, you know, is picking, cleaning things up, and Harry's just like, after you left, she cried for a week, probably longer, only she didn't want me to see. There are loads of nights where we never even spoke to each other with you gone. She's like my sister. I love her like a sister, and I reckon she feels the same way about me. It's always been like that. I thought you knew. And, like, Ron is, like, crying.
That's kind of, I was glad he kind of made that confession to Ron, too. And it shows a little bit, it shows emotional intelligence on Harry's part. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, poor Ron.
Yeah. And Ron's like, I'm sorry. He said in a thick voice, I'm sorry I left. I know I was a... He looked around at the darkness, hoping for a bad enough word would swoop down upon him. And then, you know, another great moment, which isn't just about the emotional intelligence, about, like, the dynamic of their relationships in the Golden Trio, but Harry's like, you sort of made up for it tonight, said Harry, getting the sword, finishing off the Horcrux, saving my life. That makes me sound a lot cooler than I was, Ron mumbled. Stuff like that always sounds cooler than it really was. I've been trying to tell you that for years.
I loved that. I mean, I feel like that was just like, thank you, Harry, for, you know, I think I've been very critical of Harry, and I think he's an asshole sometimes and whatever, but he, I don't know. I thought that was a great moment between Ron and Harry, for Harry to say, like, yeah, I've been trying to tell you, this is not, yeah, like, Ron has probably built it up in his head so much, and Harry's just like,
yeah, because, you know, we had that fracture in Goblet of Fire where Ron couldn't handle the attention and the perceived glory, right, that Harry was receiving, and he's always struggled with it, and now finally he had to do something, you know, heroic, and he's like, right, oh, this isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Right, right. It's kind of it's a moment, it's over, and then you have to keep going on with life. So,
yep. Yeah. And so they go back to the tent. Hermione is asleep. How do you feel about Hermione's reaction to seeing Ron?
I think Hermione is fighting her feelings a little bit. So she had, I don't know. I think I was kind of, like, annoyed with her, but then I was kind of like, well, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I'm obviously throughout, if you hadn't noticed in us reading these 7 books, I'm taking a far more feminist lens to this rereading than my last rereading a few years ago, which was more through a pagan lens, you know, focusing on those things. But Hermione's reaction, of course, it's comical and, you know, eases some tension after such heavy shit. But I've kept thinking, you know, obviously I, you know, again, not that Ron doesn't deserve a bit of, like, pushback or just be like, oh, Ron, you're back. Not that he directly deserves that. But I can't help but think about how much is Hermione feeding into the, like, oh, hell hath no fury, like a woman scorned, blah, blah, blah. That sort of, you know, archetype, stereotype. Because, and especially the way Jim Dale, I don't know, did you read or listen to this chapter?
I listened to it, yeah.
Jim Dale. I listened to it too. And the way I've listened to these books before, and I never thought of it this way, but the way Jim Dale, like, portrays and exhibits Hermione's, like, pure venom, it almost makes me think of Bellatrix in terms of, again, her being, like, deranged and losing her shit.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, and even Harry's like, Harry has never seen her, like, lose it to this extent.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, So Hermione.
Yeah, so, again, so I a part of me had a little bit of issue of, you know, that sort of stereotype of that, yeah, you know. But it, again, that's the thing, like, it can be devoid of either or, you know, any gender of the people you hate the most are usually either people you loved or you feared, you know, because the opposite of hate is not love, it's indifference.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because she's so pissed off that Harry has to cast a shield charm between the two, and she's like, give me my wand, I will kill you if you don't give me my wand.
Which, that's something that I didn't kind of mention, is that Harry has a wand. Because Ron brought one for him, right?
That's... Yeah, so while he was standing watch, Harry was using Hermione's wand.
Oh, Hermione's wand. Okay, I'm jumbling it up. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then Ron discloses it later, again, when he's explaining that he was able to grab a spare.
Okay, yes.
In his little adventures by himself.
With some snatchers.
Yeah, so apparently there are these snatchers, which are in essence like the bounty hunters going after the Jedi. We've got snatchers going after like muggleborns or dissenting half-bloods, anyone who is, you know, not all for the new regime. And so, you know, Ron got stuck with some of them, was able to shake him off, but he splinched himself and lost a few fingernails.
He's got to work on that a little bit.
Yeah, he's got to work on that. And Hermione's just like, oh, fingernails, poor you. We got ambushed by Nagini and Voldemort.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Hermione, I was kind of like, oh my gosh, okay. But
yeah, and she's like, gosh, what a gripping story, Hermione said in that lofty voice she adopted when wishing to wound. The fact that Harry, like, understands, like, this very specific tone of when Hermione wants to be vindictive.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, and then, and so it's like, how did was Ron able to get back? And we find out it's the Deluminator that Dumbledore left him.
Yeah, because at first they were kind of like, what is this random ass thing? Well, I forget what he left for Harry. I know he
left the snitch.
Beetle Bard. The snitch. Okay, yeah. Still haven't.
Yeah, and then, yeah, Beetle, Tales of Beetle the Bard for Hermione. And then he left the Deluminator to Ron, which they knew, you know, at face value, the Deluminator, like, you know, takes and restores light.
Yes.
But it clearly does a little more than that. And
right.
Was able, you know. Again, not exactly sure the mechanics, again, because this is, like, Dumbledore's, like, own invention, the Deluminator.
Oh, okay.
It seems to be some sort of, like, following your heart's desire, and it'll take you to where or who you want. Because its essence kind of serves as a portkey, even though, like, Ron describes it as, like, the ball of light goes into him, like, into his heart, and he just, like, disapparates, and he apparates where Harry and Hermione are.
It's like Ruby Slippers or something, in a way.
Ruby Slippers, something of that ilk.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And bluish. It was a ball of light, kind of pulsing and bluish, like the light you get around a portkey, you know? So, yeah. So clearly, Dumbledore is mixing up some portkey shit, some apparition shit, and some Mirror of Erised crap going on.
He was good at his job. Ride or die.
Yep. And so he uses that to follow Harry and Hermione, Yeah, Harry and Hermione. I'm so used to saying Harry, Ron, and Hermione, like the Golden Tree.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then finally, you know, then he goes into seeing the Patronus. And then they show her the destroyed Horcrux. And Hermione's like, and it went just like that? Well, it screamed. He threw the locket into her lap. Gingerly, she picked it up and examined its punctured windows. Deciding that it was at least safe to do so, Harry removed the shield charm. And so it seems that this destruction of the Horcrux seems to have pacified Hermione temporarily.
Temporarily, yes. Yeah.
And Ron is like, could have been worse. Like, she could have sent the birds at me. And Hermione's like, I still haven't ruled it out, came Hermione's muffled voice from beneath her blankets. But Harry saw Ron smiling slightly as he pulled his maroon pajamas out of his rucksack.
So we're making progress back to the level playing field, I guess.
Indeed. And thus we transition to chapter 20, Xenophilius Lovegood. And again, not directly that Ron deserves like an easy, you know, a welcome back party. But you know, Hermione's like throwing a lot of, you know, passive aggression and shade. You know, Harry had not expected Hermione's anger to abate overnight and was therefore unsurprised that she communicated mainly by dirty looks and pointed silences the next morning. And Ron responded by maintaining an unnaturally somber demeanor in her presence and an outward sign of continuing of continuing remorse. In fact, when all three of them were together, Harry felt like the only non-mourner at a poorly attended funeral. During those few moments he spent alone with Harry, however, Ron became shamelessly cheery.
So he's putting on an act to, like, basically it sounds like he's letting Hermione ride it out. Like, she,
yeah,
he's over it, but I mean, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's interesting. It's an interesting dynamic because, as you know, and probably many people know, like, with the, I, like, will ship Hermione with, like, anyone and everyone except Ron. And, you know, not that, I'm sure there are some fine Harmony, Harry, Hermione fanfics out there.
Oh, okay.
I just, yeah. You know, I just don't naturally gear towards them because I like the idea that the main guy doesn't get with the main girl. Like, I liked the respect that is given to the platonic friendship of, you know, of them with as Harry being the protagonist.
I have to say I've appreciated that about Harry Potter too. Even before I read it, it's like, well, yeah, people can have friends of the opposite sex.
Yeah. So yeah, this sort of Ron, you can interpret it as Ron being very, like, smug with himself, or, you know, or you can take it as Ron understanding their, you know, their dynamic and not, like, trying to, like, fight back or trying to be, or just sucking up being like, yeah, I deserve this, you know.
Yeah, right.
But right. Yes, it's, again, it's all about how you view Ron and Hermione's relationship, and I have never viewed it all that favorably, so
I feel like she could have ended up with somebody better. Mm-hmm. Victor Krum. Anyway.
Yeah. So now that they've destroyed the Horcrux and now they have a means to destroy future Horcruxes, life suddenly seems a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, we just gotta go find some more Horcruxes at this point.
Yeah, so, like, they go into their routine of, like, arguing, like, where to go, where to find it, but it's all done with a lot more, you know, optimism and enthusiasm. And there's a point where Ron and Harry, like, go out to avoid Hermione's brooding. The boys go out to, like, scavenge, and Ron tells them that the name Voldemort is now taboo. It has some sort of tracking magic that's been put on it, and that's how they got found. So what do you think of that little tidbit?
I'm trying to think about what I think about it, because, like, they're for so long there nobody in the wizarding world would say it, and it was kind of like that gave it power, and now it literally does have power. If you do say it, it has power. So yeah,
because, and it took a while for them to figure this out, because Ron admits, like, it almost got Kingsley captured and cornered, because, and again, Ron says it's brilliant. It's like only the people who are a serious threat who are going to be like, fuck this, you know who, I'm going to call him Voldemort. So only the right people who are really a threat are going to say it. And then, you know, just all bets are off if you say it.
Right. Yeah, it's a good trick. I mean, Voldemort's smart to do that, because I'm sure he is aware that this is something that people don't say.
Yeah, I didn't write this as a note in my notebook while reading this or listening to it, but I just thought of it now, because there are a lot of cultures. Well, what, you know, there are things like Beetlejuice, if you say it.
What is it, the Bloody Mary?
The Bloody Mary. The idea that if you say something's name, that will conjure it into existence. And then I was watching, like, you know, I was watching one, you know, one documentary about, like, the various, like, werewolf legends in the continental United States. And there was an indigenous person, you know, discussing, like, the Native American variant and basically saying, like, you don't talk about it, otherwise you're going to, you know, summon it. So that's ingrained in a lot of cultures. And I think in a modern context, that manifests itself in the way we approach sex education. The idea, if you even talk about sex in any way, that's suddenly going to make, like, teenagers super horny, or, like, give, like, oh, you have permission to do sex, which I blatantly disagree with. It's like, we can talk about something and not, like, directly endorse it, or, like, you know, knowledge is power. So again, that notion of, if you just talk about something, you're going to summon it, like, that, you know, just sociologically, that's that manifests itself, you know, since the dawn of time across all cultures.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, it's just like these don't say gay bills, right? Like, just the fact that people know about being gay, that's going to, all of a sudden, everybody's going to be gay. I'm like, sorry, it's just not the way it works.
Yeah, I was watching a Vice News piece. It was about a debate, like, of, you know, people on opposite sides of a debate. And there was one teacher there who I think identified as male, but he was wearing makeup and stuff. And he told a story of, like, he's a teacher, and he started a school year where there were 25 students in his class, and the parents got one look at him, and the next day he had 19 students because, like, the parents were so adamant, like, not my child being around this so overtly, like, you know, not conforming to traditional gender forms of appearance.
That's very stupid. Very stupid. I'm sure those people went to church every Sunday too. Sorry, not to be an asshole, but seems to be the way it goes.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, so now we've got, you can't say Voldemort, otherwise it'll bring the Death Eaters or Snatchers a knock in and appears.
Scary.
And then, you know, they were talking about Kingsley because, you know, he barely escaped. And it's like, could it have been Kingsley with the Silver Dome? He's like, no, Kingsley's a badass black wizard, and his Patronus is a Lynx, damn it.
That is pretty cool. Lynx is pretty cool.
Yeah, they saw it at the wedding. And then Ron is speculating, could it have been Dumbledore?
No. can you produce a Patronus after you die?
I don't think so.
Okay. Because, I mean, that's the conversation that they have.
And even if Dumbledore was alive, his was a phoenix, his Patronus.
Yeah, right.
And so then Ron is the like, Patronuses can change, can't they? Tonks changed, didn't it?
I have no idea who this freaking Doe belongs to. And I don't think I...
No theories whatsoever?
I mean, it's not Hermione's. Hers is an otter, as yeah. I, like... puzzled out after I accused her of not doing it. I mean, the only thing that I could think of is it's like, and I don't know if this is something that's even possible in this world, is it's his mom in some capacity. And that would make sense because his is a stag, but I don't know.
Oh, so ghost Lily Patronus.
Ghost Lily Patronus. Don't even know if that's a thing that we can do in this world.
Was I doing a Freudian slip when I called it a deer ghost?
No, their Patronuses are very ghost-like.
Yeah. I don't know. What's so funny is, like, you know, again, I keep switching between Patronuses and Patroni. Do you know the grammatical rule that dictates when a plural becomes, like, comes the I or becomes Patronuses or Patroni?
I do not.
The rule is if the word is Latin in origin, it becomes the I. If the word is Greek in origin, it becomes the S's. Or the other way around. Other way around. Okay. But anyway, yeah.
Because I've heard people say it's octopuses, not octopi. Because people say octopi and they're like, it's not right. That's octopuses.
Yeah, because, you know, one of them, either or the other. Because I think Greek, you know, if it's octopuses.
That's interesting.
Anyway, so.
Patroni. I like the linguistic information here.
Yeah, my time to shine as a linguistics nerd. Anyway, so let's see. So yeah, they're trying to puzzle out Dumbledore's sort of like riddles, and Ron's like, I don't know. Sometimes I've thought when I've been a bit hacked off, he was having a laugh or just wanted to make it more difficult, but I don't think so. Not anymore. He knew what he was doing when he gave me the Deluminator, didn't he? He knew I would run out on you. No, Harry corrected him. He must have known you'd always want to come back. And that cute friendship moment. But yeah, because Ron is exhibiting a sense of self-awareness that, you know, Dumbledore knew what I was like, my insecurities. He knew I would leave.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Dumbledore knew them pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so while they're just, you know, hypothesizing, theorizing, you know, Harry's been using the spare wand that Ron was able to get from one of the Snatchers. And he's just practicing, like, mundane spells. And so so Harry takes the spider that's in the middle of Frosted Rebs and starts making it larger.
Asshole. And Ron is like, could you please chill? And he's like, oh, I forgot. I'm like, yeah. Did you though?
And it's like, stop that. I'm sorry I said Dumbledore was young, okay?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what did I do? Oh, Harry had forgotten Ron's hatred of spiders. I guess we have to think this has not been a book with an unreliable narrator, so.
Yeah, let's see. And obviously Harry's been struggling with this wand because obviously it's not his own. And, you know, again, it's an absolute last resort because, again, there's no way he can get a wand that it's more suited to him. Because obviously he can't stroll into Ollivander's. And even if he could stroll into Ollivander's, as we know, Ollivander ain't there.
Yes, very true.
Yeah. And Hermione is like, you know, you just need to practice. It's all a matter of confidence, Harry. And it's like, bullshit. Because it's an uncharacteristic level of deflection from Hermione, which I guess we're supposed to take of her breaking character so much because she feels so, so guilty and can't deal with the guilt right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think this is just like, right? I don't know.
Yeah, because she's
very
she's
much going, did not seem like her fault.
No, well, it's not her fault. And although Harry didn't do any better of like, you know, saying it's not your fault, like he didn't directly like accuse her of anything, but he was so brooding and upset about it that so she becomes, to me, that's just you just need to practice, like that's just as annoying as like the pushing the occlumency crap.
That's kind of the moment I thought about when she said that, and I was like, oh, are we doing this again, Hermione? Like, come on.
Yep. And let's see. And Ron is trying to find, like, the rebel radio show.
This reminded me, it reminded me of something not related to World War II. It was something else, but. Oh, it reminded me. It took a dark turn. It reminded me of, I can see his face. Alex Jones, for some reason, but I know it's. Quite the opposite, like, you know, not that I think Alex Jones is in any count. I think he's trash. So just let's get that right.
Yeah, of course. So finally, Hermione comes up and says, I want to go see Xenophilius Lovegood.
Random. That's kind of what the reaction is, like, what the hell?
Random because she has become Hermione's become fixated on the very specific symbol. Because she realizes that with the A of Albus's name is not just a normal A, it's like the circle and the line and the triangle, and which was the same as the one Xenophilus Lovegood was wearing, which is the one that Victor Krum wanted to punch him in the face about.
Right. It obviously means something more than just like something that looks cool.
Something that looks cool, and because that, regardless of its origin. You know, it seems that that symbol was appropriated by Grindelwald, and that's what it's most known as. Like, the same with the swastika, you know, originally a Hindu in origin and, you know, becoming, you know, appropriated by crazy people.
Right.
That comes up a lot in paganism as well, in the pagan groups, because there are legitimately, like, super racist and white supremacist pagans, I forget the exact name, but those who follow like the more Norse pantheon, appropriating like Thor's hammer and like other things, and or even the way the pentacle, you know, the pentagram, you know, the five pointed stone has been appropriated and affiliated with Satanism, and the idea of, you know, when is it appropriate to take back a symbol and fight that, no, this is not what it means, we should be using it to diffuse like the negative meaning, or is it been so tainted by negative meaning like the swastika that there's no way you can, you know, you can untaint it and move on to something else.
I tend, at least for the
pentacle, I tend to be more like, you know, again, I have pentacle earrings, like I'm all for, at least in the pentacles case, I want to like take it away from stupid people who want to say it's all about Satanism, and it's like, fuck you.
Right. Yeah. I think I did last time when we talked about this. I checked my shirt to make sure I didn't have a pentagram on it. I have shirts with one on, but not that I am a Satanist. I'm not.
Yeah. And even if you were a Satanist, like, the pentacle would have to be upside down with the two points upward, not...
I checked the shirts that I have, and they are. I was like, oh, God, what am I doing?
Get it right, Jess.
So, yes. They're heavy metal band shirts. I mean, there's, you know, yeah, how it goes, but...
Okay, so... so, yeah, so... Harry's a little bit miffed because he perceives this as being just as outlandish as his desire to go to Godric's Hollow. And look how that turned out.
Yeah.
And he's peeved at Ron because Ron's just being a sycophant, just going along with whatever Hermione wants to gain brownie points.
Yeah, which, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Love is blinding. That's what I have said over and over again.
And she's like, maybe it's something you need to find out for yourself, said Hermione with a faint air of clutching at straws. Yeah, said Ron sycophantically. That makes sense. No, it doesn't, snapped Hermione.
she's onto it. But.
Yeah. I think we should vote on it, said Ron. Those in favor of going to see Lovegood. You know, and it's like, outvoted, Harry, sorry, said Ron, clapping him on the back. So jovially.
Oh my goodness, yes. That's funny.
And was all's fair in love and war, said Ron brightly.
All right, Ron, like, rein it in.
So it seems that, well, first term, before they go into the, like, going to Lovegood, you know, Ron makes the connection of, you know, because Harry and Hermione presumed that he would go to the Burrow, but that's not where he went. He's like, do you know how pissed my family would be if I told them I ran out on you? Like, my parents, especially Ginny.
Right.
So he was not at the Burrow, but he instead was, you know, at Bill and Fleur's place.
Yeah.
And it's like, Bill's always been decent to me. He wasn't impressed when he heard what I'd done, but he didn't go on about it. So that's just an interesting thing because obviously Ron is not the youngest, but he's the youngest son. And Bill is the absolute oldest son. So we just haven't gotten very much of their dynamic, just those two.
Right. Yeah, that's very true. I mean,
you know, so it's
more
it's
so kind of, with the twins and Percy.
Yeah, because I think most of Ron's insecurities come from the siblings, the male siblings closer to him, you know, Fred and George, and to a lesser extent Percy. I've never felt that Bill and Charlie were the ones giving him such a hard time. Although what we see from the Horcrux is that clearly he feels, you know, again, there are different, you know, he's the youngest son, but clearly he doesn't feel like he can get his mother's attention as much because apparently Mrs. Weasley always wanted a daughter.
Yeah, but that's something that Voldemort played on too, or the Horcrux did when all went down.
Anyway, so again, nice little tidbit into... you know, Bill and Ron's relationship. He knew I was really sorry. None of the rest of the family know I was there. Bill told Mom he and Fleur weren't going home for Christmas, blah, 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 blah. So let's see. So apparently the Lovegoods don't live all that far away from the Weasleys, it seems.
Yeah. And they have a very unique house.
Their house looks like a chess piece rook.
Yeah. Makes sense. They're quirky.
Honestly, if ever I become a best-selling writer who can, you know, live a life of independent means, you know, everyone has, what is it, like, the man caves, there's she sheds. Like, do you know what I want?
What?
I want a tower that's eventually, like, you know, a rook. I want a tower, and each floor will be devoted to my various hobbies. Like, one floor of the tower will be bookbinding stuff. The other floor will be my cupcake baking. The other floor will be, I don't know, what are my other hobbies in life?
Reading. You gotta have a library.
Yeah, a library, of course. And then the other one, the like next floor, be podcasting studio.
I like it. It's a good thing to think about. Mm-hmm.
So that's my she shed, like a whole Rapunzel-esque tower of all my hobbies.
The Tower of Amy.
Yes. And then there's a broken down gate, and it's like the Quibbler editor X Lovegood. The second, pick your own mistletoe. The third, keep off the dirgible plums.
You know, I don't expect like normalcy from the Lovegood, so right on brand.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So they go and, you know, there are two aged crabapple trees. There's a, he recognized the snargaluff plant. And then he recognizes like the orange radish-like fruit Luna sometimes wore as earrings.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cute.
Yep. And so they knock on the door and Mr. you know, his mouth fell open in a perfect comical O. Hello, Mr. Lovegood, said Harry. I'm Harry, Harry Potter. Xenophilius did not take Harry's hand, although the eye that was now pointing inward at his nose slid straight to the scar on Harry's forehead. So what do you think of Xenophilius's demeanor?
I mean, we kind of can't blame him. Not because of any sort of, like, I guess the way I perceive it is, like, who does Voldemort want to, like, take down? Harry Potter.
Yeah, who is undesirable number one, and who shows up on your doorstep?
Exactly. You're probably going, oh my god, here is enemy number one on my doorstep who wants to come in my home. Like, what is going on? So, you know, I think his reaction is a surprise makes sense. I mean, we also know that Luna and Harry's relationship is good. Again, another good platonic friendship. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this is the guy that was a jerk to my daughter. It's just like, this is enemy number one. So GTFO.
Yeah. And yeah. And so, but Hermione is like, Mr. Lovegood, what's that? Because there's a gray spiral horn, not unlike that of a unicorn. It is the horn of a crumble-horned snorkax, said Xenophilius. No, it isn't. And Harry's just like, Hermione, not now.
Yeah.
Not
chill,
now.
Hermione.
But
right.
Apparently this thing is super explosive. According to Hermione, so if like, it is what she says it is, like, this could blow up at the slightest touch.
And he basically says it's a different thing, right? They're like arguing about what it is.
Yeah, and it's like, I bought it, said Xenophilius dogmatically, 2 weeks ago from a delightful young wizard who knew of my interest in the exquisite snorkak, a Christmas surprise for my Luna. So, yeah, like, that whole thing that reeks of, like, Hagrid getting the dragon's egg from the sketchy guy at the pub.
Yeah, yeah, this is all, I don't know, it's very strange.
Well, I guess, you know, Xenophilius' response to that is, again, at the end of the year, as you know, I was reading a lot on, like, white Christian nationalism and white supremacy and that sort of stuff, and it's just like, do you have any evidence? And it's like, no, there's, you know, they have nothing directly to pinpoint, but then that just makes them dig their heels in more.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But anyway, why exactly have you come here, Mr. Potter? We need some help. And the thing is, helping Harry Potter is rather dangerous. Which makes sense, but they also bring out the point that according to, like, the grapevine of what they've been hearing, like, the Quibbler has been very supportive of Harry and not cowing down to the mainstream, you know, narrative that's infiltrated by Voldemort. So I guess they're all surprised by this sort of hesitancy when it's coming in the face of knowing that publicly Xenophilius has, you know, put himself out there already.
I mean, I guess, yeah, it's one thing to write about it and keep a distance from it. It's one thing to another thing to have it show up on your doorstep, like, literally.
Yep. And then, you know, there's like, it's like, okay, I'll go get Luna. And so they're, you know, kind of one, you know, looking around, and they were very high up, just looking out the window, and he's like, Ginny was over there somewhere. They were closer to each other today than they had been since Bill and Fleur's wedding, but she could have no idea he was gazing towards her now, thinking of her.
How romantic. I'm fluttering my eyelashes. It's very, very...
I know, that makes me think of, I was reading a little bit of Romeo and Juliet the other day, because I wanted to reread some of those, like, you know, those very classic, you know, lovey-dovey soliloquies and monologues.
I love Romeo and Juliet, but I know I'm a loser. Everybody make fun of me. It's fine. I don't care. I like it.
Yeah, well, I feel like I would appreciate it more if they were older.
Yeah, that would have been better, but I don't know. Yeah. Ask Shakespeare what he was thinking. Or she. I don't know.
Yeah. So they hear the banging, and apparently what they hear, like, rustling above is, like, a magic form of a printing press, which is printing out copies of the Quibbler.
Makes sense.
Yep. Who was it? Ah, you have spotted my pet invention, he said, shoving the tray into Hermione's arm and joining Harriet. Modeled fittingly enough upon the head of the beautiful Rowena Ravenclaw, wit beyond measure is man's greatest treasure. So.
All right.
You know, she's like, you know, was it Luna? You know, Luna's just picking up enough whatevers, you know, whatever fishies to make stew for all of us. Do sit down and help yourself, sugar. Now, how may I help you, Mr. Potter? Well, said Harry, glancing Hermione, we wondered, it's about that symbol you were wearing around your neck at Bill and Fleur's wedding, Mr. Lovegood. We wondered what it meant. Cynophilus raised his eyebrows. Are you referring to the sign of the Deathly Hallows? Holy shit, that's the name of this book.
Yeah. And then I was like, damn it, I have to stop reading. So I don't know. But yes. Finally, some explanation on what the Deathly Hallows are.
Possibly. Yeah. So, one very important chapter of getting Ron back, getting Sword of Gryffindor, getting Horcrux destroyed.
Hanging out with the Lovegoods.
Yeah. Keeping up with the Lovegoods. Which I would take the Lovegoods over the Kardashians any day.
Oh my gosh. Same.
Alrighty then. So let's start off with our first exercise, Gothic Geek Out. Did you want to share?
I forgot to do that one.
I'll start then first.
Okay, please do.
Okay, so, no, that's fine. Mine was, I think, pretty obvious in terms of the fake darker selves of Harry and Hermione rising forth from the locket. Because, you know, the idea of facing your darkest self, that is big. Like, it's not, this isn't even specifically gothic, but what I think of is, you know, the classic Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, one of the, if not a mini boss, or it's not the full, is it the full boss? No, I think it's a mini boss, but one of the most iconic elements of Ocarina of Time, or any Zelda game, of the Water Temple, is facing Dark Link.
Okay, yes.
So it's basically, you know, a shadow of, you know, it's basically an evil form of Link, like your evil twin.
The shadow self.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe.
Yeah. The shadow self. And again, it's for Ron, it's not directly his, like, shadow self, but again, it's confronting his absolute worst fears, which is, again, used as a device. You know, that's a huge crux of the hero's journey. Story
arc. Oh yeah, just facing your dark side, quote unquote.
Yeah, your dark side, or like your worst fear, because, you know, for Ron, it's, you know, he just feels so inadequate next to Harry as the celebrity and the hero, and he feels so inadequate compared to Hermione, who is so smart and, you know, who does not have the fame but has all the brains and has the sheer magical power that I don't think even Harry has.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That's a good one.
I'm just trying to think, you know, facing your fears in a more, because in the Gothic context, facing your fears tends to take the shape of facing the past, like possibly with a family curse, maybe not as literal as that, but, you know, or, you know, facing in some more subtle Gothic novels that criticize, you know, certain social hierarchies and you know, aristocracy, you know, facing your fears of that your way of life in the aristocracy is coming to an end, like in the 20th century. So that's facing that fear is a huge part of Gothic literature. And then, yeah, I'm just trying to think of something more equivalent, like more directly facing one's fear. Do you know what I think of? Have you watched The Muppets Haunted Mansion?
I have not. No, I have not.
Well, the climax of the movie is when Gonzo gets to a point where, you know, again, they're in the Haunted Mansion and, you know, I'm not scared of anything. This is all fun. But it gets to a point where he does have to face his worst fear and his dark self.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
So that's the closest to Gothic stuff. I pulled out Muppets Haunted Mansion.
Hey, that's a good like beginner Gothic thing. My computer freaked out. I was thinking about, as you were talking, and you know, like I said, I'm in Ding Dong and I forgot, but we talked a little bit about Arthurian legend and the sword and the stone, and that's not really necessarily Gothic, but kind of rooted in mythology and the hero's journey. There's a lot of Gothic things. I mean, fighting an enemy, things like that. I'm just thinking of like reflection on the past or link to the past in some capacity. You know, all vampire stories kind of build off of Dracula, and I don't know. That's not really necessarily Gothic. Okay, fine. This one was a hard one to pull something Gothic out of this week. I'm not going to lie. The only thing, I guess, is being in a forest, which again, I can't think of a good a lady in the lake thing. I don't, you know what? I'm out this week. I can't find a good one. So sorry.
Okay.
Somebody's going to listen and be like, this was the Gothic thing. And sorry.
Alrighty then. So then we can move on to Tarot of the Day, which I was picking the card like right before we started. So the card I picked, we may have picked up this one before, the Queen of Cups.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't quite remember either. I think we've done a King of Cups, but here. The Queen of Cups is nurturing, caring, compassionate, and sensitive. When you see her in a tarot reading, you are embodying her nurturing mother energy. You support others by listening with your heart, being compassionate and caring for them deeply. You are empathetic and can sense the needs of others by tuning into your intuition. And you hold the space for others to express their emotions and be the truest, most authentic versions of themselves. So I think when Ron returns, that Harry is exhibiting a lot of the Queen of Cups qualities.
Specifically when he returns. Harry does kind of handle Ron a little more gently. I don't know if that's the right word, than he has in the past.
Yeah, he does, which is a reversal of roles from in the ways that Harry handled Ron, again, throwing this, I can't deal with Harry Potter's glory anymore in Goblet of Fire. Because in that instance, Hermione was the more understanding one and had to explain to Harry what is going on in Ron's head. And now we have a point where it's not that, again, Hermione was able to pick this up, you know, even several years ago, but she knows exactly what Ron's deal is, but is not willing to be nice to him about it in the way that Harry's willing to be. But again, Ron just saved Harry from drowning.
Right. Yes. Yeah. No. Water, the cups. There we go.
Yes. And then, yeah, going, dipping into a cold, freezing pond to get a sword.
As you do.
As you do. The Queen of Cups says you are highly intuitive, creative, and in flow with the surrounding energies. In your interactions with others, you can easily read other people and get a sense of how to communicate effectively. Again, like Harry exhibiting this more so than... Exhibiting this way more so than...
Whether the Queen of Cups appears in a tarot reading, you are being asked to trust your intuition and pay attention to your feelings and emotions. Lead with your heart, not your head. So, if anything, Ron leading with his heart in this sort of chapter, it does so in the positive way that is exercising in a lot of self-reflection.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like Ron specifically showed some growth in this chapter.
Yeah.
I mean,
showed growth.
He's shown more growth in this book than others.
Yeah. And if anything, there's been a role reversal between Ron and Hermione, where Ron is being the more emotionally intelligent one, and Hermione is just like, I'm sick of being the mature one.
Right. Yeah. She's definitely kind of, yeah. I mean, we all get to that point. She's cracked. She's like, you know what? I'm done with these boy emotions. Mm-hmm. Come on, man.
Yeah. Alrighty. And then we can move on to the Black Moon astrology cards, which the one I picked at random was one of the houses. It was the 10th house.
10th house.
The 10th house. And the subtitle of the card was the world. You know, underneath the
title. Oh, okay. Okay.
Which is interesting because the world, like, is its own card in the major arcana of the tarot. But okay. The 10th house, the world. Fame and the world at large. In astrology, the 10th house, which is at the top of the zodiac, embodies the masculine principle and represents the father or a primary male influence, or at least a very powerful, influential man. If you haven't noticed, I'm reading this with a little bit of hesitancy because I'm scared. I'm scared of what I'm going to find the last time I read this book.
Yes, I remember.
About what was it? The moon?
Yeah, it was.
The darkly moist and yielding?
Yeah. Darkly. It's like we're reading fan fiction on the podcast. Oh my god. Yes.
I may get into some, like, you know, fanfic audiobook stuff, but today or this podcast is not for that.
That is not that. But maybe you can get some ideas from this book, this Dark Moon Astrology or Black Moon Astrology.
Okay, but so yeah. So I'm just scared I'm going to come across something out of left
field
again. If you
do, it's good for the writing. That's what I would say.
Okay. So all masculine MC, because the 10th house opposes the 4th house, it can sometimes represent the woman or the mother in your life. But mostly the 10th house stands for reputation and standing. This is an ambitious card. It's about owning the world and being on top of the world. It is the ultimate card to have for when you need to be confident in what you are doing and go for what you want and nothing less. Because the 10th house is the house of your favorite Capricorn, it indicates that you are about to put forth a diligent and concentrated effort. The climb to the advancement of your reputation is what the 10th house can mean when it turns up in a spread. So if anything, you know, so if the 10th house is all about, like, your social standing, where you stand in the pecking order of our socially constructed world, then in essence, the majority of what the Horcrux, what Riddle preys upon in Ron is all of his insecurities about him feeling like in so many aspects of life he is at the bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah, I think that's I was thinking too, I think that's, you're exactly right when it comes to Voldemort. I was thinking of reputation and the reputation that Harry brings Zenophilius Lovegood's house, you know, his reputation precedes him.
And yeah. Just think of xenophobia, the fear of the strange. Xenophilius, the love of the strange.
Oh, that's cute. Okay, I didn't know that. It's good to have a linguistics person around.
So yeah, just all about interesting ambition. Because again, we don't think of Ron having ambition directly because he's always taken such a, like, passive role and just not thinking there's nothing I'm good at where I can achieve. And even if I did achieve it, one of my brothers has already done it. So it doesn't matter if it's the second, if I'm the second, because I'll be the second one who does it.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Why didn't they make Ron a seer? Or why didn't Ron get the dragon? Like, give him something so that he can.
Something.
To feel, like, confident in, besides fucking Quidditch.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm just trying to think in terms of, because again, we could talk about Harry, you know, his, you know, fame and standing. Like, you know, there have been periods in his life where his celebrity has not always worked for him in terms of, you know, when the ministry went against him, but never to the extreme of he's literally on the lam because of his social standing and what he represents to the opposition.
True.
So it's just thinking, it's kind of the, like, the paradox of, because he's so famous and has so much social capital in the original sense of the series, is the very reason that they're scrounging and barely surviving eating mushrooms, because they're on the run, because all that social capital has the opposite effect now.
Yeah. You just made me think we haven't had a Quidditch chapter yet, and then I got very distracted thinking, is this book not going to have a Quidditch chapter, or will it, and it's going to be like a like battle to the death or something. So sorry.
I think the closest thing we got was which Harry wasn't even on a broom, but the whole battle of the seven Potters, because there were people flying around on brooms.
You know what, Harry? Fine by me, because I have shown I don't really enjoy the Quidditch chapter. So, okay.
Okay.
Well, reputation.
Yep. Alrighty then, and then we move on to our final exercise, fan fiction time.
I just was going to talk about the moon being dark and moist. No. but speaking of dark and moist, I was thinking about, what if Ron hadn't showed up?
Like, of
to
course.
Save. Of course, exactly. I went with the low hanging fruit because I'm brain dead. but do we think that would? Hey, what was Hermione up to at that time? Remind.
She was asleep. She was asleep.
So we may have lost Harry.
If the purely, if we want to stay as canon as possible and just remove Ron out of the picture, Harry would die, and then be like the end.
The end. Then Ron and
that would be if this was written by George R. Martin, and then the next chapter would be like Hermione, like 19, and Hermione waking up to find Harry's body in the pool.
Awesome. No, no, this is not the George R. Martin book. But that was the thing that I thought. Well, what if he didn't show up?
What
if he showed up in a different capacity? Like,
yeah,
lost it.
I guess the question begs mind. Let's say that, you know, Harry took the Horcrux off and was able to get the sword. I guess that begs the question of, what would the Horcrux, what would the little piece of Voldemort's soul, what would it manifest to Harry to try and distract Harry from not destroying it? So what sort of visions, what sort of darker self would the Horcrux present to direct Harry directly?
That's a good question, because we don't really perceive Harry as lacking confidence. As
not lacking confidence, I think more so in this part of the book than like previous chapters of them being on the run. Harry is talking more and more and thinking more and more about Ginny, and so I think it would be like Ginny coming, you know, a riddle version of Ginny coming up and saying lots of terrible shit to him.
I think that, or I think it would have been, if it's possible to show, like, make him think about Ron and Hermione really are only his friends because of his proximity to fame and who he is.
Or because of such as his hissy fits about Dumbledore, if a darker version of Dumbledore appeared and be like, you idiot, you couldn't read any of my clues, you didn't get anything right, you moron.
That's probably exactly what happened, because I feel like and Dumbledore would say, like, and I didn't tell you anything because I thought you were an idiot or something like that. He would have been like, oh my God, he would have lost his mind. So I could see that happen.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what I think about. And then just by extension, if we want to extend it further, like, what if Ron didn't show up and, like, you know, Harry had been like, Hermione, there's a silver toe, come look. And they both go. And, you know, if Hermione was the one to destroy it, what would it manifest to her?
Again, like, I think, you know, because it played on Ron's confidence, it's like, well, of course it's not going to do that. I don't know what that was. Hermione, gosh.
I think partially it could just be the easy one of a riddle version of Ron appearing and saying horrible things to her, like abandoning her. Of course I abandoned you. What are you? You're not good enough. You're this, you're that.
You're a piece of trash.
Yeah, because I think, because, again, the great thing about a lot of fan fiction, especially a lot of Hermione Granger-centric fan fiction that I've read, is you get a lot of, you know, character development of why she is the way she is. And a lot of people, fanfic writers, veer into this notion of Hermione is such a perfectionist because she doesn't feel like she's good enough. And that cripples her, and that sometimes that's purely portrayed as being not feeling good enough because there is a legitimate prejudice in the society she finds herself in, where she's a muggle-born witch, where people think that she's lesser than by default. And then there have been other people who explored further that, you know, even if, you know, even before her entry into the wizarding world, that not that her parents are like evil, but her parents are very like the typical type A achievers and putting so much pressure on her and like thinking, I have to be perfect. I have to be perfect. I have to be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm trying to think about Hermione because I feel like she's kind of the opposite of me. So it's hard for me to put myself in her shoes. I mean, I know I'm not super perfectionist, but I want things to be right. I don't know. Hermione. Isn't that what, who called it her, that Victor Crumb?
Yeah, Hermione.
Hermione. That's what I keep hearing in my head tonight, so.
Yeah, so, so that's good fleshed out of the low-hanging fruit. I'm not displeased. I had another one of, what if the helper, the caster of the Do Patronus, what if they had revealed themselves? Like, again, stepping into your theories of who you think it could be. Again, you were stepping into, you know, Lily Potter's ghost.
Yes.
Lily Potter's ghost, or any other ideas, because like what is the point of staying hidden if they're an ally?
I'll go back to proximity to Harry Potter, and, you know, help assisting, aiding and abetting a criminal in Voldemort's mind. You know, we can't say his name. Yeah,
for all we know, it could be Xenophilius Lovegood who sent that.
It could be. There is a possibility. The other name I thought of was Neville. I don't know how, and I don't know why, but Neville won.
Oh, because we don't know Neville's Patronus, do we? We don't.
We don't. We don't know what he's up to. I don't think he's been mentioned in this book. Maybe in passing, but that's it.
So, yeah. So
maybe he's like doing that. Nobody saw that, but Amy.
Alrighty then. So, yay! That concludes our last exercise. Tune in next time and we'll get into chapters 21 and 22, The Tale of the Three Brothers and the Deathly Hallows. Interesting stuff. Lots of world building, lots of folklore. It'll be fun stuff.
Good. Something to look forward to.
Indeed. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.